previously on Monster Talk.
I was sort of stewing on this and living my life. And then one day I came across the book, The Mothman Prophecies, and it was the Illuminette Press sort of large format paperback version with the Frank Frazetta painting on the front. And I think I'd always heard about the book, but I didn't really know what it was about, and I didn't know who John Keel was or anything. So I picked up the book and I read the back of it, and I went, this is it. This is my movie.
Join us now for part two of our interview with Richard Haddam, screenwriter of The Mothman Prophecies.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
This is part two of our interview with screenwriter Richard Haddam, who wrote the screenplay for the 2002 film The Mothman Prophecies. If you haven't heard part one, I would urge you to go back and listen to it, and also to check our show notes at monstertalk.org, where you'll find links to many of the books and films referenced during our discussion. We hope you enjoy this interview with Richard as much as we had recording it.
Monster Talk.
Richard, I'm curious to find out what you think about the recent Chicago Mothman sightings.
Well,
if you've heard about them.
I've definitely heard about them. I feel like I need to circle back into a bit more research because I was sort of plugged into the first wave of stories that sounded really interesting and compelling in that they were different from each other. It didn't necessarily feel like people were just mimicking the last story they'd heard. And some of them seemed very strange, and a lot of them didn't even sound all that much like Mothman. They sounded more like a, you know, almost like a winged person. I've heard like, oh no, we found out that a lot of those reports have been considered non-legit. But I haven't looked into why, but I heard, and I don't want to spread, you know, rumors, because I think it gets difficult because people go, you know what, if I'm just going to get called a liar and I'm already freaked out, then I'm not going to talk. And that's right. Not where we want to be. We want to be where people are like, nope, I feel totally okay talking about this. I took some notes. Let me explain what I heard or what I saw or what I experienced. That's kind of where you want people to be. Good witnesses. But anyway, so I guess my answer is I'm not sure. It all sounds really weird and interesting, but it might be a little bit I've heard of cases where over the course of a couple days, people will experience similar things. But when it goes on for weeks and weeks, even I sort of go, really? That sounds different. That's an outlier. Most phenomena doesn't work like that. Even the weirdest stuff doesn't get described like that. So that's kind of where I am with it.
We did a show on this.
We did. I'd say check our show notes for the Mothman Chicago episode we just did with Allison Jornland.
Cool. Okay, great.
She's done a lot of on-the-ground research into this, and she's very much an open-minded person. I don't know how she describes herself. I mean, she's a ghost researcher, and I think she's you know, my impression was she's probably more inclined to believe maybe than I am. But, you know, I'm a terrible.
Would like to believe.
Yeah, I mean, but we would, too. I mean, I don't know. I liked her. She was good. And she did some very solid research on the ground, trying to, like, go back and check the facts of the stories. And unfortunately, it seems like that she's being, I don't know what the polite way to say this is. That people are not receptive to anyone taking a critical look at this. I'll say that way. So, but you can.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I wonder who's sort of personifying that point of view.
I think it'd be clear if you check out the episode.
Oh, cool. Oh, all right. Then I'll check it out. Say no more. But if you've experienced something, well, now you're in a different league, and it's sort of like, well, now I'm going to sort of understand where you're coming from through that prism, because you must. That experience trumps everything, whatever that experience was, and however it's eventually explained.
Yeah, one of the horrors I have is that one day I might see a Bigfoot, and then I'll be stuck with the position of I'm very skeptical. I know unless I get a sample, I'm not going to be able to convince anybody. How disturbing would that be? I mean, you know, so
right.
I always want to be ready. I mean, I'm that skeptic. I'm that weird guy who doesn't believe but is always carrying a camera and stuff to collect samples. So just in case, right?
Or you might think it's just a person in a suit.
Well, they're going to die because I'm going to try to get that body. So sorry, pal. You picked the wrong guy to hoax. We had just talked about Kiel being a seeker of the numinous, if you don't mind going back to that line of thinking.
Well, the thing to remember about John Kiel also is that he grew up he was a writer, first and foremost, and he did write fiction. And his nonfiction is so well written, it has the feeling of a fictional narrative. Even something like The Mothman Prophecies, which, you know, from page one to page last does not – you know, tell a complete story necessarily, but episodically he renders what is happening in Point Pleasant so well and so entertainingly that you know, it's informative as to who he was as a human being. By saying this, am I saying that he made stuff up? I don't think so. But I think he was interested in getting this information across in a comprehensible and entertaining way. And I think there is a difference. I've read many, many books of the paranormal. Many of them are just so dull you want to kill yourself.
Yes. I too have, and I have a huge collection of paranormal. I would say my bookshelves are probably 80% pro paranormal, 20% skeptic, something like that. I mean, if you don't familiarize yourself with the material, then it's really hard to talk about it from an informed position. I don't think it's really safe to rely on other scientific researchers to sort of be your filter for all this stuff. So, I mean,
The thing about the scientific research, it's this weird thing, and I'm just sort of, again, this is my own personal journey, stuff I'm sort of coming to and thinking about now. There's always this sort of reflexive side of the paranormalist or the investigator that's like, you know, science isn't taking this seriously, and if, you know, if they would just turn their attention to this, then you know, we'd get some real answers and stuff like that, or we've already proved that ESP exists, you know, and it's an established scientific fact if they would just admit it. But you know, a couple things, you know, on the one hand, I begin to, you know, a skeptic or a debunker will often sort of hold the bludgeon of materialism, and they will approach a witness who says they have had perhaps an alien encounter of some sort, and they will say, well, where's the physical evidence? You know, you bring me a UFO and you bring me a body of an alien from another galaxy, and then I'll believe you. But until then, it's just a story. And what that person is doing is sort of dragging a subject onto their field through a particular set of rules or norms, and then saying, see, it doesn't work. And I wonder if materialism is ever going to be able to appropriately explain or evaluate the experiencer experience, because those experiences seem to be so largely psychic, psychological, that we may be trying to force two things together by asking, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson to really start figuring out what's going on in an alien encounter. That's calling a plumber to fix your, you know, your electricity. You know, we may be using the wrong tool here.
It's
called parapsychology for a reason. It's not called paraphysics. It's not called paraphysiology. It's called parapsychology.
Yeah, I think I may have mentioned in my email to you that I had actually considered going to West Georgia College when William Roll was teaching there to become a parapsychologist. That was one of the
– wow.
Yeah, he taught – I mean, that's about 70 miles from my hometown. It was one of the things I was really seriously thinking about was going to learn about that because I was really interested in it. I went a different route, but I think what you're hitting on is what I always like to think about is the filter problem. You've got the scientific methodology, and what it does is it demands, you know, a testable hypothesis. You have to make experiments, right, and you want it to be repeatable. There's these words that people will pop up, and you'll hear them in conversations about this all the time. And what do you do when the thing you're trying to test is not easily repeated, right? So, you know, James Randi had the $1 million challenge, and, you know, part of that would have required him to find people who could reproduce their skills over and over again. And for things like I saw a ghost, it's an experience that I would assume over the history of man, billions of people have experienced. People, you know, certainly millions of people alive today believe in ghosts, hundreds of millions, no doubt. Proving it's an entirely different thing. Everybody can experience it, but quantifying it is hard, right? So,
right.
Yeah.
And I'll admit that as I get older, my wife asked me this the other day, and it was really sort of the perfect question. She said, well, do you really want proof? Would you really feel happier if tomorrow morning you woke up and it's like, well, it's been proven the soul exists and there is an afterlife? Would you be happier that day? My answer was no. I would not be happier. I would, I mean, it's such an odd question because part of me would go, I don't believe it. And then it's like, well, wait, now I'm the skeptic. Or, well, who's saying it? You do get into some weird areas. It's something I talked about recently with some do you know Rob Christofferson? I never know who crosses over through Astonishing Legends. He does the Our Strange Skies podcast.
No, I don't know him, but I've listened to it because of the his being mentioned. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was chatting with him, and I was sort of saying, you know, this vast difference, because, you know, a lot of UFO stuff has come out, like in the New York Times and the Boston Globe in the last, you know, 6 months about the government's, you know, there was a secret government program, you know, within the last 10 or 15 years.
And, right.
And it looks like Robert Bigelow's got something in a Las Vegas warehouse that's extraterrestrial and all this stuff. And I'm like, something isn't sitting right with me and I can't figure out what it is. And finally, it just sort of, it crystallized very obviously. And it has to do with, I mean, you've heard of the disclosure movement.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's like, well, one day the government's just going to finally, you know, say, okay, here's what we know. You know, the aliens have been here. We picked up the crashed disks at Roswell. We've got some alien bodies. Well, one of them was still alive. We've established a treaty with these people. They're from, you know, all this stuff that supposedly they know and are keeping under wraps. Now, compare that to any other human story you've ever heard about any kind of alien encounter. It's weird. It's bizarre. It makes no sense. It's non-physical. It's frightening. You are passive to the point of being victimized. We're not even talking about the same things now. And on the other side, there's no one on the non-government side is saying, well, yeah, a disc crashed and I actually have it in the barn and I've got some bodies. If you heard that, you would immediately go, well, that's horse shit. So how are these two things existing side by side? The minute you get government clearance, it all makes sense. The bodies are there. We've talked to the aliens. We've got a treaty. It's all good. No one on the government side is saying, this is the weirdest fucking thing in the world. We're out of control. We're terrified. I was brought on board, you know, a ship and examined, and told some really weird nonsense and then put back in my – floated back into my bed. No general is telling us that, okay? So who's selling us? Who's lying, you know? It's such an odd thing. It would be like if the government said, oh, we've got a special ghost unit, and we've figured out ghosts, we've got a treaty with the ghosts, we know exactly what they are. You wouldn't believe that for a second.
Right,
so again,
yeah.
Taking the UFO experience and dragging it into the material and going, it's got to be material, it's got to be aliens from another planet. That was something that got floated early on and became something that the public imagination hooked onto because of science fiction tropes. But the actual alien intelligent energies encounter experience, if you actually read them, is very, very far away from that. And so often we're not even talking about the same things. Once again, the material versus the psychic.
Well, yeah, but if you go back to the history of ufology, the fact that Ray Palmer was such a big part of the promotion of UFO stories, I think, and the fact that he was also a science fiction publisher.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that much of a coincidence. You know what I mean?
That's exactly right. That's why we all think of it that way, because there was someone going, well, this is to my advantage to characterize it in this way, and if people think some of this stuff is real, they'll read my magazine because it's entertaining, and they think there might be some secret cool information that's real.
Yeah. I am absolutely fascinated by the history of this stuff, which is why we keep talking about it, because the history of ufology ties in with the history of magic and esotericism and, you know, secret organizations. It's all – even though – a lot of that doesn't specifically deal with monsters, I felt like I needed to branch out and at least cover that, because the impact of those movements and the way that that's developed culturally has absolutely influenced the way people deal with stories about Yeti and Bigfoot and lake monsters and all of this stuff. It's all about how we deal with things that don't fit in that sort of scientific paradigm, I think, to some extent, right? And so,
right? Yeah, I think people actually have a tendency to try to make things fit.
Yeah. I do want to make the point, though. So as a skeptic who cares about this stuff, I know you haven't listened to our show that much, but we describe ourselves, or at least I like to describe ourselves, as we're in a ghetto inside a ghetto, because we're people already.
That's one too many ghettos.
Yeah, right. We're already a ghetto in that we're looking for scientific explanations and sort of rejecting the paranormal unless there's proof. But now inside that group, very few of those people are also really interested in these topics. So like,
you're pissing everybody off.
Right. And so we find ourselves in the strange position of loving monsters and caring deeply about the people who have these experiences, but also wanting to find out what we can actually demonstrate is true and what we can't. And it's a peculiar place to be. A lot of times it ends up with I hope that our stance of actually just saying, okay, what can we actually demonstrate about science using these topics? That's a fun thing, right? So I can say, well, we're going to talk about Bigfoot and then use that to talk about human evolution and relict hominids and the, you know, hybrids, and talking about lake monsters. We talked about plesiosaurs and what can we learn about them as real animals, that sort of thing. So all of that's interesting. And then we learned about psychology and biases and all the sort of limits of human perception. And then you see things like this week, it was the, Yanni and Laurel audio file, right? So you've got people experiencing the same exact sound file, but getting entirely different data out of it, right? The information they're receiving is entirely different based on their head as a filter, right? So it should be a big reminder that you can see the same thing as someone else and come to entirely different conclusions. But
it's so I totally agree in it, but it's so funny. It's like people will talk about electronic voice phenomenon. And a common explanation for that is, well, you're just, it's like staring at an audio Rorschach. You're you're hearing something and you're saying, ooh, it's saying I'm dead. But this person over here is hearing Laurel or Yanni or, you know, whatever.
Right.
They're hearing something completely different. But my question is, well, wait, what is the sound? Like, why is there a sound where there should not be a sound? Like, I understand that people interpret things in different ways, but if something is there that shouldn't be there, that's my – let's answer that question first. There was this guy – I'm sure you've heard of him, Ted Serios, the guy who did Thoughtography.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The guy who get drunk and then make pictures appear. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And he would, you know, I mean, he's a classic case. I mean, I could, you know, spend, you know, the rest of my life talking about that guy. But what was really funny is the guy who wrote the book about him, Jule Eisenbud, you got to picture a guy who's sort of like, you know, trying to make his bones as a parapsychologist. And, you know, he's looking for his, you know, white whale to finally prove some amazing thing. And he's getting older and it's not really working. And then one day he hears about this, you know, drunken bellhop in Chicago who can think images onto film. And he's like, all right, I'll go check it out. And he does some experiments and he's like, wait a second, I think there really is something going on here. Yeah, I mean, I've got my controls and everything. I'm really excited about this. And he goes to the magazine he was working for or that he sometimes sold to, and they did some experiments right there. But he couldn't get any traction because they would sit with Ted Serios and go, okay, all right, think about an old clipper ship, an old sailing ship. And then he would think about that, and then he would, you know, then they'd go look at the film, and there would just be like trees or a building or something. And they're like, well, it's you know, it's inconclusive. You know, he couldn't really do what he said he was going to do. And Jules Eisenbud is like, but there's trees. There's a building. It's like, don't get angry that he didn't do that. There's stuff on the film. They're like, well, but it's not what you said it was going to be. And he's like, oh, come on. So he continued writing. But it is this odd sort of, you know, yeah, there's all kinds of weird perceptions of things. But like, let's just go to a soundproof chamber and run a bunch of tape recorders and see if anything comes up. So let's get rid of the radio waves. Let's get a Faraday cage. Let's get rid of all those other explanations and see if something's there. And then let's not rush to decide what it is. It's an alien voice. It's the voice of the dead. It's this. It's that. It could be your own voice. People have recorded anomalous voices of people who are alive in other states.
So you're always – well, not always, but in the interviews I hear, you're always interested in these experimental approaches, which I love. I think that's – I love it when we get to do those, right? So that's one of the challenges. Like there's so many times we'll come up on a case and we'll think, oh, well, all we need to do is figure out this or here's how I would test that. But then there's very few people in the country who have both the access and the time and money to actually go do those tests. It's really frustrating. And especially since a lot of us who are interested in this stuff are not professional scientists, right? So,
right. It is tough. And my feeling is that experiments only get you 50% of the way.
Because yeah.
All an experiment is ever going to do, and really all any experiment in parapsychology has ever done is, if we don't get into the argument of, well, they did the experiment wrong and it's lack of control and whatever, but you can get evidence of something anomalous, but that never tells you, okay, now here's the theory that we apply that explains what that thing is and what it means to us as human beings. All you can do is, well, the picture is not a fake. Well, the audio tape, you know, whatever. But it's like, but beyond that, what does it mean? What is a voice of your dead mother or brother on a piece of recording tape or a phone call from the dead? What does it ultimately tell us about the afterlife? Maybe nothing. In fact, maybe all of this stuff doesn't tell us anything about the afterlife. Maybe there's a consciousness that can separate from the human body and have an out-of-body experience. Maybe that is true, but maybe that only works with an alive body. And once the body dies, that separatable consciousness dies with it. We don't know. So you can't jump to anything. But people want to because they want it to mean what they want it to mean.
Yeah. As I knew before we started a conversation, we're unlikely to come to satisfactory conclusions regardless. It's like people, it's like the SPR. I mean, if you look at them, I was so happy that I heard you mention them. So like a lot of the modern, you know, ghost hunters only know, you know, from plumbers on, right? You know, they don't have the full history of the field in their minds when they're thinking about these topics. But the search for proof, like I like to think about it, is the numinous, or the search for that there's more out here than just the physical world, has been going on for a while. And it'll keep going on after we're gone. But Kiel, in the Mothman Prophecies, I think a lot of what he starts out the book in, very early in the book, by the way, if you haven't read the book, read the book. It's really interesting. And if you haven't seen the movie, watch the movie. It's really good.
And if you've seen the movie, read the book anyway, because the movie is 5% of what was going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. How would you make a movie out of this? I mean, it's really the tough question. So I see how you did it, but when you had to look at – so for people who haven't read it, I would say one way to describe it is a collection of many, many bizarre incidents that John Kiel collected around Point Pleasant, West Virginia in the late 1960s. And some of them sort of swirled around this character of Mothman, but they also involved UFOs, possibly an alien – an interesting character named Woody Derenberger, and ultimately, at the end of it, his book needed an ending, and he was receiving what he felt like were prophecies, that he was being warned about something terrible happening, but not what actually happened. And ultimately, there's a huge bridge collapse, and many people die, and I think in the end, Kiel feels like maybe that's what this was all about. Maybe. It's a little unclear. But it's even as vague as that sounds, it's a really good read.
Yeah, it really is. And it was kind of tricky because there's just so much stuff you want to put in, like just so many weird, you know, Men in Black encounters and all kinds of weird stuff. And a few scenes were included in the script that were either never filmed and some got left out of the movie. So it really it was the experience of writing it was like, OK, like just. Find an emotional through line that it again evokes those feelings of trying to get solid answers to vague questions and the impossibility of that. And what I tried to do is create a narrative where every time he tried to nail it down, it escaped him. It was like, I know you're trying to get us, but you're never gonna get us, John Klein. And he kept But he did all these smart things, and he really tried to get it, and he couldn't get it, and it made a fool of him. It was like he was Charlie Brown, and Indrid Cold was Lucy and the football.
Yeah,
and every time he tried to get it, they're like, "No, no, no, not that easy," and finally he's just like, he goes over the edge because then they cruelly dangle. The one thing, because he's ready to give up. He's like, you know what? Screw it. And they're like, ooh, we're losing his attention. Hey, want to talk to your dead wife?
Yes.
the most alluring. I mean, and that gets down to what everyone, you know, goes to a medium or a fortune teller for anyway. It's just finally they're like, okay, you know what? All right, we're done goofing around. We're going to give you the answers to life and death. You're going to talk to your wife. You're going to actually get the answers you've been looking for from the beginning. And it's thank God it's a human being going, really, you're gonna wander into a bar just one more time?
Yeah. <You
know? laughs> it's Laura Linney calling him up going, how about you don't? How about this time you say no to them and you just put it all behind you? Because that's what happened in the book. In the book, John Kiel was going nuts and he called up all of his, you know, UFO investigator friends and they all said to him, well, you know, there is a way, but you're not going to like it. You got to throw it all away. Turn your back on it. Burn your notes. Throw the books in a dumpster and stop thinking about UFOs. And you might get your sanity back. And so, you know, that's what happens to John Klein in the movie. And it's only when he finally says, I'm not going to listen to any of the noise, that suddenly the universe realigns and he gets to where he needs to be at the moment he needs to be there to reassociate himself with an actual physical human relationship. And that's that was the conclusion of the movie, which, of course, nobody got. They're all like, I don't get it. He never fought the Mothman.
Right. In a real sense, I think this movie works as a proxy for what a good X-Files movie should have been. It does. And also, it feels very Lovecraftian to me, if you don't mind.
Oh, interesting. How so?
How so? Because in if you take Lovecraft literally, a lot of the things that you've got these cultists trying to break through to these what they see as gods on the other side. But ultimately, those creatures don't care about us. They're beyond us. They don't. They're alien. They're different. We're not important to them. In The Call of Cthulhu, you've got Cthulhu sending out messages. In that particular case, the aliens want to come destroy the world. But a lot of times, what they're doing is not evil. It's just beyond our human understanding, right?
Totally.
And
totally.
So that's the feeling I got watching it, was that whatever's going on here, the within the fictional narrative, the protagonist is never going to be allowed to understand. And the more he thinks he understands, the more likely he is just making up his own story.
So, yeah. Totally. Absolutely. Hey, have you read a book by an author named George Hansen called The Trickster and the Paranormal?
No, but I'm writing it down.
Oh, you got to write it down. This is a guy not well known in the parapsychological world, but a guy I think you would really like. He is well acquainted with the skeptical world and well acquainted with the parapsychological world. George Hansen, and doesn't surface a lot. He just was on. Do you ever listen to Radio Mysterioso with Greg Bishop?
No. But I'll add it.
Check
to the
that
list.
One out too. Check that's a he's Greg Bishop is a UFO thinker, smart guy, entertaining radio show, and he got George Hansen on and they talked, and it was really interesting. It's a point of view I have not heard a lot, and this is a guy who, from what I can understand, does feel that there is phenomena, but also is a magician and is familiar with skeptical arguments. And he said one of the most interesting things about what motivates skeptics, or what might be motivating some of the more vocal debunkers, which is kind of crazy. But you want to hear what he said?
Sure.
He was like, look, there has been as long as there have been people around, there have been these experiences. And people claiming to have these experiences, but kind of like what we were talking about, very rarely are they beneficial. And there actually might be, in a weird way, a sort of survival aspect to skepticism. There might be an aspect that is actually just a very rational human instinct away from the non-physical and the way it manifests. So this might be a survival tool that humans have developed.
Do you mean like a rationally protect yourself from the maddening effects of these sort of non-understandable things?
Yeah, it's kind of like what Keel's friends were telling him.
Yeah.
Stop thinking about it. Because often it feels like that's what skeptics are saying, you know. Stop thinking about it. It's a waste of time. It's foolishness. We have bigger and better things to work on, like, space travel and curing diseases. And guess what? They're right.
Yeah, well, it's frustrating because when you look at all the things that people could be spending time on, I imagine asking whether or not Bigfoot's real is probably pretty low on people's lists, right? But the only way I'm able to justify it myself is because two things. One, I think it is a model of thinking that can help you with maybe more pressing issues, but teaching you about something perhaps you're not as emotionally invested in. Right? Some people are very invested in Bigfoot. I like to say that in the world of Bigfoot, you see all of, well, in the world of cryptozoology, you see the whole spectrum of human belief writ small, right? I mean, you've got from agnosticism to complete religious fanaticism, all about this one small topic. But most people don't have that passionate, I'm willing to take up arms to, you know, for my side, yeah. Right? So I think it's a relatively safe place to sort of play out these questions. But
yeah.
But you can take the skills you learn if you use Bigfoot as the whetstone whereupon you sharpen your critical thinking skills. You could take those skills and apply that newly sharpened knife to other more important questions in your life, I think, and maybe that will put you in a better place. But that's one way I justify it. The other way I justify it is that people, whether Bigfoot's real or not, people experience Bigfoot. And if we don't address the fact that people are having these experiences and listen to them and try to understand what's going on and help them if they're having problems, or at least acknowledge that people have experiences that you can't explain, I think that's really losing part of humanity, the potential for empathy there to just get a better idea of how people really are. I mean, that's part of the human narrative.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. There is something essentially very, very human about these questions.
Yeah.
I'm beginning, I'll tell you, this is going to, you know, it's going to sound crazy, but more and more I'm beginning to think that Bigfoot, in the stuff that I've been reading and hearing, I'm beginning to suspect Bigfoot is moving away from the physical. And in my mind, I'm beginning to think of Bigfoot as more of a not entirely physical thing, that it might be more into the camp of the alien encounter, the ghost encounter, the strange being, the chicken leg woman, you know, that there's the way some of those encounters are described, I'm almost thinking it's got to be two different things. One, non-physical and is experienced psychically, and the other possibly, and in a way maybe more unlikely, a physical, living, breathing animal that we simply do not have full proof of yet.
Well, you've probably heard Joe Nickell talk about ghosts, right? I assume. He has the thing.
He
used to partner with a guy named Baker. I think Nickell and Baker used to work together, and Baker had this thing. So when you ever hear Nickell say this, he always credits Baker. But it's there are no haunted places, but there are haunted people. Or only.
Yeah.
And so so without rejecting the existence of ghosts, I totally agree, as a person who's experienced it myself, you could totally be haunted. I mean, the experience of experiencing a ghost, whether they're a real thing or not, like whether they are a dead person or whatever, people experience hauntings. That's just true. Right?
Yeah.
Because a haunting is a conclusion. Right? A haunting is, this is what happened to me. People experience Bigfoot. Whether that's really a bear or something,
yeah.
or it's a real animal or it's something else, they experience Bigfoot. I mean, and when you meet people who've seen Bigfoot, it's not like someone who saw a kangaroo. It's different.
Yeah.
because I can't prove that, but I do know that people experience angels, people experience religious visions, and people experience Bigfoot. So,
well, now, yeah, and now I'm going to say this stupid thing where it's like, well, you know, and then we have to ask ourselves what we mean when we say real.
I think
most people sort of go, well, real, like I can pick it up. And now we're back into materialism. And so my equal opposite pull would be an invitation to say a thing does not need to be physical to be real. And if we broaden our definition of reality to include these experiences, then materialism does not become the only tool we have. And maybe we can start looking at other ways to talk about human experience, which for the people who experience these experiences is very real, and to have that conversation on a more even footing. And this is not to say you literally accept, because I like my thing is push the fence posts back as far as you can. And even when people who have experienced something try to begin to define it or explain it or say, well, you know, I had a near-death experience and I met Jesus. When I hear that, I don't go, oh, shit, Jesus must be real. I don't do that anymore.
Right.
You know, I go, okay, what I'm hearing is a person had an experience and this is the language they are using to express it. But let me not listen to the Jesus part and get distracted by it as much as let me listen to the entirety of the experience and see if that from beginning to end feels like other things I've heard about other people having other experiences, whether it be alien, Bigfoot, ghost, or whatever. And when you do that, it's like stepping back from a 3D painting. Things actually begin to come in focus, and you go, oh, wait, that connects to that. Actually, these things do sound a lot alike. And our constant urge to piece things off, and you get Bigfoot, and you get UFOs, and you get ghosts, has slowed us down, I think, in understanding a general notion of what a person experiences when they experience something unexplainable.
True that. I tell you, it's interesting to me. Well, obviously, I wouldn't be doing this show and be on like 155 episodes if it wasn't. But the fact is, if we could stop there and say, okay, we can acknowledge this. I, even as a skeptic, I know people feel these things really happen to them. That's easy. And but the challenge is that people who have these experiences often insist that other people believe them. And belief for me is really hard to come by. So like if someone has a life-changing Jesus experience, they see Jesus and he gives them a really important message they need to tell to everybody. Well, why would I believe that? You know, I mean, it's what's going to compel me to believe that? And what if that message is that I need to do something that I don't like, or I need to stop doing something that I love? That sort of prescriptive aspect of the story, you know, it's if I have to believe, I have a problem because I can't do it. I have a really, my push the button and I believe button is broken. Something's happened to me. I used to be able to believe all kinds of things, and now I need way more evidence to really believe in something. And
you want answers. And I think maybe the people, you know, all kinds of people have experiences and filter through the prism of their mind, their beliefs, their past, their upbringing. And they themselves may begin applying a narrative after the fact, thinking that at least they will gain audience with some group of people. That if I sort of wake, okay, look, you and I do this too. You have a dream, and the dream is evokes an emotional response from you. It was very scary. It was very weird. It was funny. It was something. But do you ever notice that when you start telling the dream to someone, you sort of start making it make a little bit more sense?
Oh yeah, I think as a skeptic, I think about it a lot. Yeah.
Because you're like, well, okay.
That didn't make any sense. You have to sort of like start smoothing it over and reforming it, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to get 10 seconds into this dream before you check out unless I go, well, okay, so it was basically, you and me, and we were in the Ralphs, down the street. And it's like, well, it was sort of like that. It was kind of the Ralphs, but it was also kind of my mom's house.
Right.
Now you're checking. I'm like, okay, I don't get it. Where are we? Ralphs, your mom's house. This is going to rewrite. Fix this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, all of my research into memory and that sort of thing is we're constantly rewriting our memories. So I don't trust memories. I don't trust my own memories. I'm appalled by this. The more you look into this stuff, the more you start to question a lot of the basis for what makes our culture work, which is things like eyewitness testimony in the legal system. You're like, no, this is all messed up.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and it comes down to like and in what aspects of our life do we accept personal testimony and when do we not?
Right.
On a personal basis, a friend is telling a story about a relationship they've had and how they're, how it ended. You listen fairly uncritically and go, well, that's they're telling you their experience. Maybe in a court of law, you're parsing it slightly differently.
It's the provisional acceptance until you start hitting the bullshit meter, right? Right.
Yeah, and then yeah, exactly, and when do you slam on the brakes and why, and that's something that everyone kind of will judge for themselves.
Absolutely, I actually peculiarly I'm 48, and about 3 weeks ago, I finally had the experience of having a dream come true. To the best of my knowledge, the first time that's ever happened.
Like a precognitive dream?
Yeah, yeah. I have
You've been sitting on this for 2 hours. Let's hear it.
No. I'm a skeptic, so I've already deconstructed. It's not that interesting anymore. But here goes. Sorry.
Okay, let's hear it. Let's take you through the whole.
So I I'll try to tell it as though I did believe it was all really significant. All right. When I graduated high school, I went off to college and then dropped out of college to join the Navy, traveled over to the Middle East for a while. So I lost track of a lot of stuff. When I came back, I found out that one of the kids I went to high school with had died in a really tragic car accident. And so it was he was not a friend. I don't want to like identify him, but listen, we talked to each other a lot. We saw each other a lot, right? So every now and then the story of him dying was so tragic, I would think of it and I was like, man, what would have become of him if he had lived, right? That it might have been a really interesting life, right? But he didn't. And so like about 3 weeks ago, I had this dream that I had gone to the shopping mall, but it was one of those dream malls. That's not really important to the story, but I wanted to give it a setting. And I was with another friend, and then this guy from our high school showed up, and I was trying to be so polite. I was like, hey, I hate to bring this up, but you shouldn't really be here because you're dead. Right. Like, I mean, how do you break that to somebody? I mean, it's I wanted to like let him know. It was like, look, I don't know where you're supposed to be, but not here. I mean, really, because you're dead and dead people shouldn't hang out at the mall. But you look great. I just want, so it was a really peculiar conversation. But it was one of those dreams where you wake up and it feels like it really happened. And so I told my wife about it, and then I called up the friend that had been in the dream with me, and I said, hey, I dreamed about that guy from high school that died. It was really peculiar because it seemed really real, like he was still alive. And so he thought that was pretty funny. So it stuck with me so oddly that a week later I was with my sister, and I said, I had this weird dream about that guy that died in high school, and I mentioned his name, and she said, he's not dead. And I said, what? And then she said, there was a death rumor that went around. I guess that was probably when you were in the Navy. And it turned out he wasn't dead. And then like we were with another lady and she said, I saw him like 3 weeks ago. And so I was, what? And so, yeah, it turned out he was not dead. He had never been dead. So, you know, it's not like he came back. But for me, he's been resurrected, right? But it was
Oh, totally.
So for me, he just came back from the dead. I mean, he's been dead for more than 25 years. It's peculiar. He's been dead for 30 years. It's crazy. And now he's alive again. And I just, we haven't had a chance to catch up, but
can you imagine if you would run into him on the street?
Oh, I would have lost my mind. Yeah, yeah. Now, it would have been even worse if it had been like in the dream, because in the dream he was still young. But I, you know, I didn't reach out to him, but I looked him up on Facebook, and he's, you know, he's aged like all of us, right?
Yeah. Oh my God.
But it was really peculiar. But I from a skeptical perspective, I'm like, I told my wife this story, and she's like, "That's weird." And I'm like, "Yeah, it's not." And she's like, "What do you mean it's not weird?" I'm
Well,
it's the weird thing is that the dream felt real, so I told you about it. If it hadn't have been one of those dreams that felt real, I would have just ignored it, and it would have gone on, and he would have still been dead to me until I found out some other time, right? The dream would have had no significance. And if I hadn't had the weird dream, I would have never mentioned it to my sister, because why bring it up? He's been dead for 30 years, right? You know, it's in every dream that I have that doesn't come true, nobody remembers those, right?
Well, right. And by the way, it's not as if like I would say, if you had a dream where you ran into this guy and you had sort of said, "Look, I hate to say this, but you really shouldn't be here. You're dead." And in the dream, he had said to you, "I'm not dead. That was a rumor.
Right.
You heard the wrong thing. Ask your sister," or whatever.
Right. There could have been a lot of ways to make it more interesting or more
and even
shocking.
And even then, it's sort of like, well, maybe I sort of knew that, or I sort of like in some way I subconsciously understood that this person might not actually be dead, or I'd heard something else but had discounted it. I mean, there are there's all kinds of dreams where people will say, "Oh, I ran into an old high school friend," or "I dreamt that I was going to run into an old high school friend," and then I did the very next day. And then a skeptical response might be, "Well, but that old friend might have been in town for a few days, and you actually might have seen them before you even had the dream, but not consciously
registered, but
it registered in your subconscious and expressed itself. And then coincidentally, you dreamt about that person. And then doubly coincidentally, you then ran into that person and made a face-to-face connection," which, you know, I mean, coincidences do happen.
One that's more amazing to me, it happens all the time to me, is I'll be at the house, minding my own business, and I'll start thinking about my best friend. And the phone will ring, and it's a motherfucking telemarketer.
Well, see, you should never think about your friends. That's just, you're just chumming the water for the telemarketers. That is fantastic.
I am such a...
Well, you know, but here's... I'll tell you something else, though. Dreams, there's no proof they exist.
I know. Isn't that weird?
Right. I mean, if I were, you know, I keep bringing up Neil deGrasse Tyson just because I like, you know, throwing around that name. But, you know, I mean, every argument against...
Do you ever call it... I've never heard it pronounced that way. Do you ever call him deGrasse Neil? What...
Wait, DeGrasse? No, I call him Neil deGrasse Tyson, right?
No. I was thinking about the DeGrasse Null from the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, no, but you know what? I will tell you this. I worked on a TV show where there was a character that we wanted. We kept saying, "Oh," and then basically this guy's trying to get in touch with Neil deGrasse Tyson to prove his theory, and so when we actually had to write that character, we knew the model, but we couldn't actually make it him, so we made it a woman, and we called her Tyra Danielle Fields.
Nice!
And we're like, maybe it'll evoke what we're trying to go for, because it's so clearly Neil deGrasse Tyson, only it's a woman. So anyway, but that being the thing, you know, every skeptical argument about well, I mean, that's, you know, all we have is your word, your witness testimony. This is an experience that you had. It's purely subjective. There is absolutely no physical proof. There never has been. Using those exact same skeptical arguments that are expected to hold water in terms of other subjective experiences could be just as easily applied to dreams. And by all logic, I have now just told you that dreams don't exist. And the only reason they exist is because more people have had them than have had alien encounter experiences. But you know what? If 9 out of 10 people had those experiences, we would be talking about them in a very different way.
Yes, that's true. We would be. I mean, well, look at shadow people. A lot of people have shadow people experiences. And so those, I think, probably ring closer to home than a lot of alien stuff, because I don't know if it's coming out in the literature that way. But it's a very, very, very common thing to see some sort of shadow entity with a hypnagogic or hypnopompic sort of experience, right? So,
well, that's another weird thing. I mean, the old hag experience, which is partially explained as a dream experience. I mean, you're sort of asleep, you're sort of awake, and you can physically study a human being sleeping, and you can physically study the mechanisms through which a person falls asleep and wakes up, the release of certain hormones, and then the release of other hormones that deactivate the first hormones that allow you to actually not move around when you're asleep, so you can actually sleep. I mean, sleep is very weird. But anyway, having said all that, there is something about the people who experience all kinds of things, ghosts and aliens, and the connection to sleep and where we are in terms of our conscious mind and our subconscious mind. And I think an argument can be made, if you are going to argue for consciousness, that it's in these fluctuating states of consciousness between waking and sleeping that can also be artificially induced. You may become more able than to physically interact with things that are less than physical. This is not saying that every dream involves ghosts, or that the old hag is definitely a ghost or definitely a dream, or, you know, but it could be something in between, because there are old hag experiences that are far more physical, you know, and that happen among a landscape of other psychic phenomenon, that even makes me question that and go, well, maybe that isn't even, maybe thinking we've got that totally explained is a slight rush to judgment. Not sure.
I'm not sure either, but I'll tell you, one of the things that I find interesting lately, you know, in my day job, I'm an IT guy, is how many people in my field are believing the idea that we're in a computer simulation, right? So,
yeah.
I find that very frustrating, because I don't think it's a very easily falsified hypothesis.
It's impossible. That'd be the least falsifiable.
Yeah, but I also think that what I don't see in those conversations and in articles is, one of the reasons it would easily seem like a simulation is because we are always living in a simulation, in that we live inside our brain, which is basically an organ that processes input that's not directly experienced, right? So we think of it as being directly experienced, but, you know, everything's being processed. There's lag. There's, you know, your vision's actually upside down. You have a blind spot. There's a lag between the time when you touch things that you can experience them. You have limits to your hearing range. You have limits to your vision range. You know, there's all these things that we don't think about because our brain filters them out. And everything is basically being sent through our filters. And we can't know what other people experience. There's this whole concept of qualia, that, like, you know, what you see as red may be different from what someone else sees as red. There's limits to human language. I mean, language is the best tool we have for communicating ideas back and forth, but we all have to come to, like, agreements on what things mean. It's a really complicated thing to be this really intelligent animal that also has to cooperate and live in a society built with other animals who are unable to fully communicate anything.
It would be a lot better if we were, as a species, either a lot dumber or a lot smarter.
Yeah, yeah, but, basically, but
this point that we've reached really sucks.
You mean, like, the fact that we're out of time?
That's exactly what I mean.
Yeah, we need to be at a bar, my friend. This is
you could say that pretty much any time to me, and I'd say yes.
Well, okay. I do have one more quick question, something about this movie thing, if you have a second. This is a ridiculously specific question, but when I was watching the movie again, I noticed that the lodge that John Klein's staying in is the Avalon it's like Avalon Motel or Avalon Lodge or something. Was that you?
Yeah.
Did you write that? Was that a deliberate choice, or was that just where they found the location? I was just
My understanding is that that's an actual location in Katanning, Pennsylvania. The whole movie was filmed in Pennsylvania in a town called Katanning. That first they scouted Point Pleasant and then realized for a number of reasons that would not work for production. But then they tried to find a town that would work that felt like Point Pleasant and you know, same era, same industry kind of thing. So yeah, the Avalon was not my choice. So I don't. Did it have significance for you?
Only from the Arthurian legends, the idea of Arthur. You know, when he dies, he goes to the island, and that's where he's supposed to come back from when Britain's his greatest need or whatever. It's sort of the sort of mystical aspects of Avalon from mythology. If you can,
I would be so happy if someone on the production team said, "Oh no, that's exactly why we did it, and we actually made the signage," because that does happen on sets. They'll make signs if legal clearance doesn't come through. Usually, I'll come up with a really cool name for a restaurant or a bar or a prod or whatever, and then immediately it's like, "Oh, we can't call it that." Or a character name. It's legally that didn't clear. Here are your choices, and inevitably you just come up with stuff that. That isn't significant to you, but every once in a while you do get to name the place, the thing you want to call it. And then that's really fun because then a prop will get made and it's like, oh, cool.
Well, because it ties in with the ultra-terrestrials. I mean, if you look at the Avalon, you've got sort of the fairy, little people sort of ties in, with Glastonbury.
Oh, yeah.
And all this, right. So I thought, oh, that's pretty subtle.
That doesn't sound like Haddam.
No. It did. It having heard you, I thought, well, that's a lot of trouble to go to like make that an illusion. And coincidence. Okay, so
I think it's a coincidence unless the production designer, one day gets in touch and says, "Oh no, that was my little nod to I'm a big fan of the Arthurian legends." Which would be awesome. And every once in a while stuff, never stop asking those questions, because a lot of times you'll get the answer yes. Someone will go, oh, no, totally. And I do that. We've done that on TV shows. Really quickly, I'll give you are you familiar with the TV show Grimm?
Yes. I don't watch it, but I'm familiar with it. Yes.
Okay. So two really quick stories. Yeah. One is in the episode of Grimm, and the premise of Grimm is that people, there's a certain race of people that also have an animal aspect, so that they're sort of also part that animal, but we see them as people, and this is sort of where fairy tales came from.
Oh, that's like really me. I'm a huge boar.
Exactly. Thank you for saying it. You saved me the trouble. Okay. So in this one episode that we did and the show takes place in Portland, Oregon. So we did an episode that touched on the Bigfoot myth, which brings it all full circle. And within the story, in different roles that had nothing to do with anything, there was a character named Patterson and a character named Gimlin.
Nice.
And people called it out. People were like, oh my God, Patterson Gimlin, they're calling it out. And then one other thing we did in that show all the time is every episode has a number. So the 12th episode of the third season is episode 312, for instance.
Okay.
And we would anytime we could, we would call it out. If that episode had a motel, they're staying in a motel room 312.
Nice.
And people started catching it. They're like, oh my God, take a look at that person's badge number or the table they're sitting at or what's on the door. And they figured out that we were calling out the episode number with little visual cues within the episodes. So fans are geniuses when it comes to this stuff. And I say, go for it, because sometimes you're right.
That's awesome. I wanted to tell you one interesting thing with Keel. So I've read a lot of his work, and are you familiar with The Beast of Gévaudan?
I don't think so.
Okay, so in the 1700s in France, there was a giant wolf creature that was allegedly killing people for real, and I mean hundreds of people died But they attributed
really?
Yeah. They attributed it to one animal. If you go back, if you ever have time, we covered it on Monster Talk in a 3-part series, which is probably the ones I'm most proud of. Obviously, cool. Till this one, right? So.
Well, yeah. You might as well just wrap it up. I think this is your final episode.
But one of the questions I had as a researcher was, for some reason, the story about this animal, it has this guy named Jean Chastel killing the animal with a silver bullet. Now, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense, because my own research into it suggested that silver bullets didn't become associated with werewolf lore until after the 1880s, which is...
But maybe it's because of that.
Well, maybe, right? So why? Why did they become involved? Well, I had to find out, so I did a whole bunch of research on it. And it turns out that American werewolf movies were what really cemented the silver bullet into werewolf lore. But there was no mention of Gévaudan having a silver bullet involved in that case until the 1960s, 1970s. And
So that got reverse engineered.
Yes. And so the way it got added, where I found two references to it. One was in the work of a woman named Joan Grant, who I guess in the 1950s was a popular fiction writer whose her gimmick, if you will, was she wrote historical novels that she remembered from past lives. So, right. So they're all – it's a lot easier to research when you don't need to do anything but remember what happened, right? So,
that's the kind of research I like.
Yeah, so she wrote an autobiography, and in that autobiography, she mentioned the story of Gévaudan and included a silver bullet in the story. That was the one place I found it. And the only other place I found it was in John Keel's writing. And John Keel, as near as I could tell, was a lot more popular with the right kind of people to get that story picked up. So I'm almost positive Keel was the one that brought the silver bullet into the Gévaudan legend. And in that strange sense, I guess Keel used a silver bullet to kill a werewolf.
I guess he did, and I would not put it past him.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Anyway, on that note, we'll move on to our final question. How about that?
Cool.
So, Richard, we like to ask all of our guests a final question, and that is, what's your favorite monster?
That's a really cool question. It kind of bounces around. I'm sure years ago it would have been Bigfoot. Now I'm kind of into there's this guy, Albert Rosales. Are you familiar with that name?
No.
He's written and compiled maybe 15 volumes of what he calls Humanoid Encounters. And these are all second, third, fourth hand encounters, but he's sort of in a weird way collecting them by year, and so you can get, you know, Humanoid Encounters 1970 to 1975.
Neat.
And he sort of goes through everything, newspapers, the internet, and day by day, January to December, gives these first hand accounts of people having weird humanoid encounters all over the world with just whatever. Bigfoot creatures, alien creatures, elves, dwarfs, centaurs, all kinds of weird. And something that comes up in those books, a couple things. One of them that I never gets talked about are stick people.
Ooh.
And these are things that have been seen in sort of the Midwest of the United States, as far as I recall. And they literally look like Groot.
<You
know? laughs> like they look, but almost maybe even more insectile or like less articulated, just sort of like almost like a line drawing of a stick man, and they moving across the highway or lingering off the side of the road or seen in different contexts, and people have very, very strong negative emotional reactions,
no doubt,
upon sighting these. But they're very rare.
Wow.
And I'm really kind of into stick man, not slender man, but stick man. And then the other one that I hear about that I really like are these people. And again, this feels like, you know, highway, you know, at dusk sort of sightings. And sometimes it's mixed in with the phantom hitchhiker phenomenon, but these are people who are half animal. Their upper or lower half manifests in an animal way. So some people have seen dog people, you know,
just hybrids.
Like people dress, yeah, the hybrids, like people just dress normally, smoking a cigarette out by the side of the road, except they've got a big dog head. Or conversely, people who will hitchhike, get in your car, and you'll look back, and they have chicken legs.
Which, I like this a lot.
It's really strange. And one of the best stories in like a book of paranormal cop experiences, I think, is a story of a guy saying, you know, my dad is a 30 years on the Chicago police force. I mean, you're never going to find a more, you know, realistic, tough as nails, pragmatic guy. And he still doesn't want to talk about the night that the woman got in the back of his car. And he looked back and she had chicken legs. And that's it. That's just his one story. And it disturbed him so deeply. And he's still uncomfortable talking about it. That to me is just beautiful.
It is.
We have local legends around here about a frog boy.
Ooh.
So, he's been around for maybe about 40 years or something, but had similar stories like the.
Well, by now he's got to be a frog man.
Well,
that's a good point.
I mean, but can you imagine, I mean, the kind of courage that it would take to go out and hitchhike if you had chicken legs? I mean, that's really plucky.
Okay, I'm not even going to try to follow that up. That is
beautiful. Yeah, leave it alone.
Really?
But those are good answers. But I think my son, my three-year-old, he just turned three, and I think he's seen Stickman before because he keeps drawing pictures of him.
Oh yeah, that's so weird. Oh, my kids are stick
on
me
the
too. Yeah,
yeah. A witness account. That's good. You got to save those. That's firsthand, firsthand stuff.
Yeah.
That's good. That's really good.
Oh,
Richard, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was a lot of fun.
Oh my God, this has been so great. I've really enjoyed it. You've reached out with such kindness, and I appreciate it so much. I'm so glad that this connection's been made, and I hope that it continues. And when I am next in Atlanta, which will either be this summer or maybe around Thanksgiving, but awesome. I would love to sit down across the table and have a drink.
Oh my God, yeah, that'd be awesome.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've just heard part two of our interview with Mothman Prophecy screenwriter Richard Haddam. Check out our show notes at monstertalk.org for links to the many movies and books we discussed during this show. Richard's TV series, Miracles and The Gates, are available through Amazon, and links to those are also in the show notes, as well as other resources that we talked about. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. Bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the City of Illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy-Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rabb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true. Conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psiconference.org.
Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
I thought you meant the fake ending, pleasure. Like, oh, Richard, it was really great to have you.
So you are gay.
Try to stifle that yawn.
No, it was really great.